So what if the person who seems the most free, like the one who never stops traveling?
Right. The one who seemingly answers to no one.
Exactly. What if that person is actually the most trapped?
Oh, man. That is like the core paradox we are unpacking today, because we frequently confuse constant motion with liberation, right?
Yeah, we really do.
When very often it is just this highly evolved, highly effective form of running away.
It totally is. And well, welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We have a genuinely fascinating set of source materials in front of us today.
We really do.
It's a collection of transcripts from this deeply serialized, incredibly rich fantasy narrative that was originally published back in 2008 and 2009.
Yeah, an older one, but so good.
But listen, we are not here today to just like recount a standard sword and sorcery
No,
adventure.
definitely not.
The mission of this deep dive is to extract this masterful psychological character study that's just kind of hiding in plain sight within this fantasy setting.
Right, it's all right there under the surface.
We are going to strip down the mechanics of grief, avoidant attachment, and really look at how the emotional walls we build to protect ourselves can slowly transform into our own prisons.
And, this matters to you listening right now because the mechanics of avoidance are universal.
Oh,
I
absolutely.
mean, you almost certainly know someone, or maybe, let's be honest, you are that someone who uses a relentless schedule, or maybe a barrage of humor, or just constant physical motion to avoid sitting quietly with past trauma.
Oh, I've definitely been there.
Right. And by watching our main character navigate his history, we get this microscopic look into the architecture of vulnerability.
So, to ground us in the material, let's just look at the two individuals at the center of this narrative. We have Redmayne, who is this fiery, highly capable Knight of May.
Yes.
She basically represents spring, life, and just charging headfirst into reality. And she rides this massive, oversized demon horse named Rhiannon.
Which is such a great detail.
Right. And her companion on this journey is Thomas. He is a mysterious, tireless fey, basically a seemingly immortal wanderer.
Yeah, he acts like this cynical, untethered loner who just constantly complains about civilization and literally never stops moving.
Never. And the contrast between their titles alone gives us our thematic map. A Knight of May, representing explosive new growth, traveling alongside a man who is actively seeking out the lands of November.
Which is such a vivid setting.
Right, it's this freezing, desolate environment that represents late autumn, the dying of the year, and, preservation in ice.
It is a perfect physical manifestation of where his mind is stuck.
Exactly. And that brings us to their arrival at the edge of those very lands of November. They've been traveling through these freezing conditions for days when they stumble upon a weather-worn stone cottage in a clearing.
And it's just idyllic.
Completely. Smoke is rising from the chimney, there's the smell of fresh pastries, and they're greeted by an elderly fey woman named Murden.
Right.
Now, instead of expressing relief at surviving the cold, Thomas immediately defaults to a performance.
He really does. It's an instant shift.
He puffs out his chest and loudly jokes that he's a, quote, November collections agent, here to collect the fairest women for a beauty contest.
Yeah.
I mean, why the immediate leap into a comedy routine when you're literally freezing and exhausted?
Because humor is one of the most effective tools for controlling the emotional temperature of a room.
Okay, let's unpack this. What do you mean by that?
Well, if Thomas can keep Meriden laughing or rolling her eyes, he prevents her from asking genuine probing questions about how he is actually doing.
Ah, right. It's a distraction.
Exactly. It is a preemptive strike against intimacy.
But Meriden, I love this. She completely bypasses the armor.
She sees right through it.
She playfully smacks him, pokes him in the nose, calls him out for being late, and pulls him into this massive grounding hug.
It's such a sweet moment.
It is. And then she banishes Thomas outside to chop a dozen cords of firewood as like atonement for staying away so long.
Typical mom energy.
Totally. And it's while he is outside performing this rugged, unbothered physical labor that Murden invites Redmayne inside, pours the tea, and reveals the foundational trauma of Thomas's life.
Yeah, this is where the floor just drops out from under the story.
It really
We
does.
discover that his wandering is not driven by a thirst for adventure at all. It is driven by a shattering loss.
Yeah.
Murden tells Redmayne about Eleanor. This was a woman Thomas loved deeply, perhaps the only person who ever truly anchored him. They were actually engaged to be married.
Wow.
But Thomas received a mandatory summons from the court. He had to leave, but he promised Eleanor he would return. It was supposed to be a temporary parting.
But, you know, the world broke that promise for him. Less than half a day before Thomas made it back from his summons, the village was raided by dwarves.
Right.
Myrdan survived by hiding in a well, but she explains how Eleanor deliberately led the raiders away from the survivors.
So she sacrificed herself.
Yeah, Eleanor was killed. And Myrdan describes the agonizing sensory details of Thomas returning to a burning village. He was calling out Eleanor's name with a voice that tried desperately to sound hopeful, but fundamentally betrayed that his nervous system already knew she was gone.
And that specific detail is vital. The trauma wasn't just losing his partner.
Right.
It was the severing of trust and the concept of a safe return.
Oh, that's heavy.
When you leave someone, promise to come back, mm-hmm. and return to ashes, your brain rewires itself. It registers the act of leaving and returning as a lethal threat.
I was reading this sequence and thinking about a very modern mechanism. Like, think about how someone today might compulsively doom scroll on their phone.
Well, yeah.
They are swiping, consuming endless streams of disjointed information, terrified of being alone with their own thoughts for even 5 seconds.
Absolutely.
Thomas is doing the exact same thing, but he uses the literal geography of the world as his infinite scroll. He just walks the earth so he doesn't have to sit still and remember the smell of that burning village.
That analogy perfectly captures the exhaustion of his lifestyle. I mean, Redmayne notes that Thomas acts like a stray cat that stuck around Myrdan's family after the tragedy.
Yeah, just kind of lingering.
Right, helping them rebuild, but slowly over the years, distancing himself more and more. And Myrdan provides the clinical diagnosis for this behavior. She says Thomas lost the ability to process closure.
Which is so tragic.
She explicitly states that he is terrified of being left behind again. If he never attaches, he never loses.
And we see the exact cost of that unhealed trauma the very next morning. Like the moment Thomas tries to escape the cottage without closure.
Yeah, the tonal whiplash here is wild.
It's fascinating. We go from this heavy, devastating trauma reveal the night before to Redmayne walking outside and finding Thomas casually nibbling on the neck of a giant magical hawk named Celestine.
Yeah.
He's preening the bird, grinning, and the hawk is magically insulting Redmayne, saying her head looks like a giant rose. I mean, why surround this heavy emotional departure with a bizarre, lighthearted physical comedy routine?
Well, it's a nervous system regulation tactic.
Interesting.
Thomas knows he is about to leave Myrdan, which triggers his deepest subconscious fears. By engaging in this absurd, highly distracting behavior with the hawk, he is desperately trying to keep the emotional stakes of the departure at absolute zero.
He just wants to slip away seamlessly.
Exactly. He wants to keep it light so he doesn't have to feel it.
But Myrdan refuses to let him. She steps out, looks at Thomas, and forces reality onto the situation. She tells him she is an old woman. Mm. She explicitly states she might not be alive in a year and the road is dangerous for him.
Mm.
She asks him to just say the word, just once. She wants him to say goodbye. And Thomas has a visceral physical reaction. He physically recoils.
He hates it.
He tries to brush past it with a casual, like, don't be silly, I'll see you again.
Right. He is attempting to sustain a delusion of permanent suspension. But Myrdan steps up and places 2 fingers gently on his lips, physically stopping his deflection. She begs him not to leave things unsaid.
I have to push back a little on Myrdan's actions here, though. Yeah, I was reading this and wrestling with the ethics of this interaction. Is forcing someone to say goodbye actually a kindness? Or is it a deeply selfish act by the person staying behind just so they can have their own closure? Like, Myrdan gets her peace of mind, but she forces Thomas to experience the exact crushing emotional pain he has spent centuries trying to outrun.
This raises an important question, but analyzing the psychology of that moment,
mm-hmm.
I'd actually argue Myrdan is throwing him a vital lifeline rather than acting out of selfishness.
Really? How so?
Well, Thomas's refusal to say goodbye means he is living outside of reality. He is operating under the delusion that actions don't have finality and people don't die.
Right.
But they do. Myrdan is effectively saying, I love you enough to force you to face the truth. Acknowledging the end of a chapter is the only psychological mechanism that allows a human being to truly move forward.
Oh, that makes sense.
If he leaves her in a state of denial, he takes that emotional freeze response with him on his journey with Redmayne.
The physical release of that moment in the text is striking, honestly. When he finally breaks, he looks utterly exhausted. He hugs her, buries his face in her hair, and finally whispers, goodbye, Myrdan.
Yeah.
It's as if dropping the heavy shield he's been carrying for centuries physically drains the blood from his body.
Because maintaining a delusion takes an immense amount of caloric and emotional energy. Once he acknowledges reality, the dam breaks.
And because he was finally forced to close that chapter with Murden, he is suddenly, almost immediately, willing to open a deeply hidden one with Redmayne.
Exactly.
They leave the cottage, and Thomas decides to take Redmayne to a place he calls the Forgotten Valley. He actually blindfolds her for the final approach.
Which is such a dramatic move.
Very. When he pulls it off, the source material paints this incredible picture. It's a valley frozen in time, brilliant red and orange autumn leaves, mist rolling along the floor, and the roar of a massive waterfall.
It is breathtaking, but critically, it is completely isolated from the rest of the world. It is a quarantine paradise.
Yeah. And as they walk down this narrow, overgrown path, Thomas is playfully teasing Redmayne. He pretends to fall down a hole, leaving her to walk alone.
Classic Thomas.
Right. And suddenly, Redmayne hears massive branches cracking above her. She draws her sword, expecting a monster, and a 10-foot-tall, 5-foot-wide, muscle-bound, white feline creature drops from the trees and roars at her.
This is Lyne, a creature whose name translates to avalanche in the old tongue.
Avalanche. I love that. Redmayne holds her ground, talks the creature down, and realizes it is actually laughing at her. And then we get the revelation that completely shatters the loner persona.
It's so good.
This ancient, terrifying beast looks at Thomas and calls him father.
It is a stunning contradiction to everything Thomas claims to be.
I was analyzing this relationship, and I kept thinking about how people project their own trauma onto others, like instead of the cliche trope of the gruff dad who doesn't want a dog that ends up loving it.
Right, the dad who's like, no dogs in this house.
Exactly, and then a week later, the dog's sleeping on his head. But Thomas's adoption of Lyne feels much deeper than that.
How so?
Well, people who are terrified of abandonment often go out of their way to rescue the most broken, intimidating, or seemingly unlovable things. Because subconsciously, if they can prove that a terrifying monster is worthy of a family and a safe home, maybe they are proving that they themselves are worthy of love too.
That is a really profound psychological connection.
Ooh.
Because the text reveals that Thomas brokered peace during a bloody conflict years ago.
Right.
Lyne was an orphaned cub, and his own nomadic people's cruel customs dictated leaving him to die. But Thomas intervened.
He saved him.
He saved the cub, fed him, taught him to speak, and raised him. He stepped in to prevent Lyne from experiencing the exact abandonment that Thomas fears the most.
And yet, when Redmayne confronts him about it, Thomas furiously blusters. His face turns red, he crosses his arms, and he loudly insists he didn't adopt a family. He was just, quote, helping out.
Oh, sure. Just helping out.
Right. He is desperate to maintain his detached lone wolf image, even while a 10-foot-tall snow leopard calls him dad right to his face.
And Lyne provides the ultimate insight into Thomas's character during a quiet conversation with Redmayne. Lyne tells her he is shorter and uglier, but his soul is not so unlike my kind, free.
That's a beautiful line.
It really is. Lyne understands something Redmayne doesn't quite grasp yet. True freedom isn't the absence of attachment. It isn't running away from every goodbye.
Right.
True freedom is possessing the agency to choose your attachments, knowing full well the risks involved.
If Lyne is the living, breathing proof of Thomas's secret capacity to love, then the physical architecture of his hidden home is the map of his repressed mind.
Yes.
Lyne guides Redmayne along a slippery path directly behind the roaring waterfall.
The transition from the wild valley into his home is jarring.
Absolutely. Redmayne emerges on the other side, expecting a rugged camp or maybe a Spartan cave. Instead, she finds an architectural marvel built into a tree that is 50 feet wide.
It's incredible.
It's a mansion. Stained glass windows, carved stonework chimneys, a wraparound porch. The entryway is entirely carved mahogany depicting the history of the world. They walk into a grand dining hall with a table that seats 40 people, adorned with weaponry representing his parents' mixed heritage.
Which is where we see the physical manifestation of his internal state.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I have to hit pause here and challenge this setup.
Okay, lay it on me.
If Thomas is the ultimate avoidant wanderer, someone who uses motion to outrun his past, why would he spend decades building a massive, highly permanent mansion behind a waterfall?
Right.
I mean, isn't building a 40-seat dining hall a sign of wanting to settle down and establish a community? It feels completely contradictory to his psychology.
It does seem contradictory until you look at how he interacts with the space. He doesn't live in the mansion.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Lyne specifically notes that Thomas has eaten in that grand dining hall maybe twice in his entire life. Thomas didn't build a home. He built a museum.
Oh, wow.
He built a monument to a past and a family lineage that he acknowledges but refuses to participate in. A monument isn't a place you live. It's a gravestone for an idea.
Okay, that makes incredible sense, because the place he actually lives is completely different.
Right.
Lyne takes Redmayne up 4 flights of back stairs, the top of a tower, to Thomas's actual bedroom, and the facade of the rugged outdoorsman completely shatters.
It really does.
It is a chaotic scholar's nest. Books are piled floor to ceiling, papers, intricate drawings, a complex spyglass pointing out over the valley, and a massive goose down bed. She even finds a book titled An Interview with a Dying Dragoon, authored by Thomas himself.
The tower room represents his hypervigilant present. He's positioned high up, observing everything through a spyglass, keeping his powerful mind endlessly distracted with academic pursuits and writing.
But right before this tour, Thomas gets a message from a hawk about some missing hatchlings and has to leave. Before he jumps off the balcony, he explicitly yells a warning to Redmayne. He yells, "No going in the East Wing." I have to theorize about his intentions here. He knows exactly who Redmayne is. She is a famously curious, stubborn, boundary-pushing knight.
Uh-huh.
Why invite her into your most secret sanctuary, leave her completely alone, and then draw a massive red circle around a forbidden room? Subconsciously, does he want her to break in?
Oh, absolutely.
Does he desperately want her to discover his deepest wounds because he lacks the vocabulary to share them himself?
That is the ultimate symptom of avoidant detachment. You desperately crave to be known and understood, but you're terrified of doing the revealing yourself.
Right.
So you set a boundary, but you hand the other person the map and the flashlight, hoping they care enough to trespass.
That's a brilliant.
And Lyne confirms this interpretation. When Redmayne asks what is in the East Wing, Lyne simply replies, memories.
The East Wing is his repressed trauma. It is the Eleanor room.
Precisely. And Lyne tells her exactly how to bypass the lock. He gives her a cryptic riddle. He says, look into the eyes of the beast and all will be revealed. The house is not just a building. It is a literal blueprint of his psyche. The chaotic tower is the frantic present. The empty dining hall is the abandoned past. And the locked East Wing is the core wound he refuses to process.
We have mapped out an incredible psychological journey in today's deep dive. I mean, we started in a freezing cottage, unpacking how a devastating, unresolved loss can force a person into a lifetime of constant motion.
Yeah.
We witnessed the crushing physical exhaustion of finally being forced to say a simple goodbye.
We met an avalanche of a son who proved that rescuing the broken things in the world is often an attempt to rescue ourselves.
And finally, we explored a towering treehouse of secrets that proves the people who act the most fiercely detached are almost always the ones carrying the heaviest burdens of connection. Thomas built a life on relentless motion solely to outrun his own stillness.
Consider the implications of that for your own life. You might not have an immortal lifespan or, you know, a giant snow leopard for an adopted son.
Right, probably not.
But the mechanics of the mind are the same.
Oh.
We all curate the facades we present to the world. We all use humor or relentless busyness or feigned detachment to control our environments. We all have rooms in our minds that we refuse to let guests see.
Which leaves us with something critical to ponder as we wrap up our session today.
Mm-hmm.
We spend so much time thinking about the locked doors in our minds, you know, the traumas we hide in our own East Wings.
Right.
But what if the messy, chaotic tower room of our daily lives, our endless busy work, our doom scrolling, our frantic schedules, isn't just an unavoidable byproduct of modern life?
Mm.
What if it's an intentional distraction? We keep the tower messy and loud so we always have a valid excuse never to walk down the stairs, stand in the quiet hallway, and look at those locked doors.
Yeah.
The question isn't just what you were hiding. The real question is, what exhausting, chaotic performance are you putting on right now so you don't have to look at it?